The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rant, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rant, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
President Joe Biden is going to get rid of clean energy in Washington so he can try to help the salmon on an issue he does not understand whatsoever. Benji Backer from the American Conservation Coalition, he will join me to explain. On-street paid parking in Seattle goes up, while we're told by folks on the council and in the mayor's office and the activist community, it's too expensive to live in Seattle. So why are they doing this? I'll explain. Plus, speaking of cars and driving, I am never, ever, ever going to use Hertz or Lyft, the rideshare company, again. I'll explain in the quick hit. I'll talk about that and so much more in this hour of the Jason Rant Show. So let's get into it.
The monologue.
So over the weekend, I noticed by the Amazon spheres that there was a pro-union protest. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, another group of insufferable socialists who are trying to take over a movement that would lead to the unionization of a bunch of workers over at Amazon. And I was, but technically I was wrong in that I, even though I didn't think this, I assumed that they were all local. It turns out that they were not. They're actually from Kentucky. Kentucky workers for Amazon flew to Seattle for a Saturday event, a direct action protest that very few people attended. So they wasted their money flying here. I think they just wanted a weekend. Maybe they took Monday off. They had a nice little long weekend and union interest maybe paid for all of this. But it happened on Saturday morning around 11 a.m. Of course, Shama Sawant was there. She apparently organized the demonstration, which almost certainly means that they paid for these people to come here. And they said, basically, look, Amazon, and I remember them also talking about PCC, the supermarket or the grocery store. Amazon is taking advantage of us. We are being worked to the bone. We're not getting compensated the way that we should. We need the right to organize. We need to get together, unionize, because only then will we be able to fight for our interests. And they are, as some protesters spoke to Cairo 7 and said, they are not treated the way that they ought to by Amazon, given the amount of output that they provide.
These people put their lives at risk in front of all of this not heavy machinery, but dangerous equipment on a daily basis.
We're tired of the retaliation. We're tired of being treated like cattle and stuck outside working hard hours and getting little pay.
Okay, get another job. That's the truth. I mean, and I know not everyone likes that answer, including maybe some of you in your own work. At some point, you make your ask, and they either say yes or no. If they say no, maybe you make your ask again 6 months from when they said no. And they keep saying no, okay, get a new job. At some point, you're going to have to get a new job. Now, they're demanding $30 an hour, which is absolutely absurd. Warehouse workers in Kentucky want $30 an hour. They consider that a quote-unquote living wage. No, you're not worth that much, because there are low skills that are associated with these jobs, which is why they're making $19 an hour, which is a lot of money, particularly in Kentucky, where the cost of living there is much different than it is in Washington State. Now, there's no doubt that Amazon warehouse employees, they are a big part of what Amazon does and how they succeed, because they're the ones who are putting the products in the boxes that end up getting shipped to us, even though they tell us overnight, it sometimes takes 4 days and sometimes it weirdly gets lost, and I'm not entirely sure I understand how that happens, but it happens, right? But they're working hard. The problem is anyone can do their job, right? Anyone can go to a shelf, pull from the shelf a pair of underwear, go to another shelf, get a pair of scissors, go to that other shelf on the other side of the warehouse and grab a soccer ball and put it all in a box and then put tape on the box. That does not require any special skills. You have to be able to lift. You have to be able to stay on your feet, right? So you have to be reasonably healthy, I guess. But that's not a skill. The people who get the most money at Amazon have a very specific skill set, like computer programming. They're engineers. They're coders. And because not everyone can do that job, not everyone has the capability, the knowledge, they are able to demand way more money. That's how it works. That's how it's supposed to work. Now, I understand that some people are going to get stuck in a warehouse job forever. I understand it. And they should be treated with respect, for sure. They should be getting paid what they're worth. And Amazon determines what they're worth based not on the demands of a socialist city council member or the people who are who she's using, exploiting to do her bidding. It's all determined by what the market will bear. If people decided not to work for Amazon for $19 an hour, let's say everyone, just go with me. Today, every single person who works at that Amazon warehouse, whether it's in Kentucky or here in Washington State, we've got one in Kent and we have one in Everett. If everyone just walked off the job and said, yeah, you're not paying me enough. Well, Amazon would go out and say to the world, we're urgently hiring. $19, maybe they throw in a sign-in bonus, but $19 an hour. If no one applies, they're going to look at that and say, well, we're going to have to add some more dollars to that. $27 an hour. And maybe you get a few applying at that point, but not nearly enough. Then you go to $33, whatever it is. You keep going until you can get someone. Now, when they charge that much or when they pay that much for individuals, understand that that's going to still be passed down to the consumer for the most part. Our packages will cost a little bit more. Our Amazon Prime will cost a little bit more. Maybe instead of free shipping at $25, they change it to free shipping at $30. So there are consequences to that. But that's how the world works. That's how the economy works. That's how it's supposed to work. And it is inherently fair because it incentivizes people to learn more skills so that they too can one day get a job that pays the six figures as it does to a coder or an engineer. I'm okay with that. It's merit-based. You work hard, you learn new skills, you make more money. I'm okay with that.
The interview.
Well, we told you last week the Washington State Supreme Court decided to redefine more words and phrases, now claiming that a capital gains tax is somehow not an income tax. So where do we go from here? Joining me on the line is Jason Mercier, director for the Center for Government Reform over at the Washington Policy Center. Welcome back to the show.
Jason, good to be on with you.
Where do we stand? What comes next?
Well, where we stand is Washington State is the only place on this planet that thinks it knows how to tax an income tax other than as an income tax. Everywhere else in the world will tell you that capital gains are income and taxes on them are income taxes, but our court has ruled. It's a 7-2 decision. Only two justices agreed with the rest of the world, and the other seven decided Washington alone knows the proper way to tax income is as an excise tax, and that's where we stand today. So what happens going forward? There's the possibility, very small possibility, you could have a federal challenge, because although you can tax income as a resident of a state, no matter where that income was earned, and that's how the other 41 states with income taxes tax capital gains income, what you can't do as a state is tax activities in other states. That's a violation of the Commerce Clause. And with our court saying that, no, this is not an income tax, this is an excise tax, that's the state of Washington saying, well, we are taxing activities in other states. Under the Commerce Clause, you can't do that. So that's a possibility. The most likely next step will probably be a ballot measure whether or not to repeal this new tax.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that. I think they knew that their legal argument was bunk, which is why it reads of a word salad that I think Kamala Harris might get a little envious of. She's like, I thought I was good at that, because this it just doesn't make any sense. And you can read one particular part which really explains where they're coming from. And just two sentences. The wealthiest households in Washington are disproportionately white, while the poorest households are disproportionately BIPOC. As a result, Washington's upside-down tax system perpetuates systemic racism by placing a disproportionate tax burden on BIPOC residents. That has nothing to do whatsoever with anything in this case, except to parrot a talking point coming from Democrats. This was ruled because they like the policy.
And whether or not a tax is an income tax or an excise tax, that statement is totally irrelevant. The majority opinion was a great op-ed from those who want an income tax, and you would see in the Seattle Times.
Yep.
As far as a legal opinion, it probably missed the mark. But, you know, just like with Judge Dredd, they are the law. That's the end of that. And now we just see what's the next step for Washington.
Now, if history serves, assuming this does go to an initiative, history tells us this would pass overwhelmingly to reject it because the Washingtonians have repeatedly said no to an income tax. The question just becomes, will it be enough to overcome the ludicrous position that folks are taking on the left, which is just basically, well, they're wealthy anyway, they're evil, let's take their money, they don't pay their fair share.
Well, and I think you know what lawmakers thought would happen had this gone to the ballot, because if you recall, when this tax passed by one vote, they attached an emergency clause to it to deny us our right of referendum, to prohibit us from putting it on the ballot and vetoing it. So they kind of thought, indicated from that action what they thought the voters would do. And to your point, the last 10 times an income tax has been on the ballot, it has been overwhelmingly been defeated. And I think that's the frustration about this. And you actually saw it referenced by Justice McLeod and Justice Charles Johnson in their dissent. Whether or not there is an income tax in Washington, whether or not our tax code is regressive or not, that is a policy debate to be had with the voters through the constitutional process, not to be handed down by dictate from the Supreme Court.
And yet that's exactly what they did. Elections have consequences. Folks don't pay attention to these races. These court justices, Supreme Court justices, they're elected. And if memory serves, the last election, I think two of them ran unopposed. We're not going to change anything unless we fix this court and fix the legislature. We've been talking with Jason Mercier from the Washington Policy Center. Check their work out. Jason in particular does outstanding job. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
Now this.
The monologue.
Well, despite complaining about how expensive it is to live in Seattle, you've got folks at the city level saying, okay, we're going to make it even more expensive. Now, usually we're talking about different policies that lead to an increase in housing costs. In this case, you've got the Seattle Department of Transportation announcing that they are raising the rates for parking. Paid on-street parking is going up. Now, SDOT, Seattle Department of Transportation, said these rate adjustments happen about three times a year in the spring, summer, and fall. They do it because they want to help ensure there are enough spots throughout the city. Meaning they're trying to raise it to a point where you can only park for, you can only afford to park for so many hours, and then you leave and you leave it open for someone else. Now, they base the number of increases and the amount of increase on street parking data that they collected from January up until, I'm assuming, the last week or maybe the end of last month. The goal is to always have one or two open parking spaces per block. So beginning today, the rates are now up by at least $1 per hour. That's the average, I should say. Most of them are up $1 an hour. Now, some will be 50 cents, but others will be up to $2.50 per hour in the mornings and afternoons. And remarkably, Denny Triangle, which is basically South Lake Union and Fremont, those will cost you $5 in the afternoon per hour. $5. That is absurd. That's absolutely absurd. And in evenings, in certain places, you're paying $4 an hour, like in Chinatown. So let's talk about the Chinatown International District. Afternoons, it'll be $4.50. Evenings, it'll be $4. Is that fair to the people who live there, who have cars? We kind of need cars. This is an attempt, as has always been the case, to get you out of your car. This has nothing to do with keeping parking spots open. This has nothing to do with that whatsoever. So we want to keep them open so there's less people idling or driving around in circles, because then, guess what? They're going to be emitting more carbon. It has nothing to do with that. They want to get you out of a car. And of course, they don't care if they're impacting people who are visiting on a weekend to go to a play or a concert or out to dinner. They don't care if you're coming in from Kent. They don't care if you're coming in from Yelm. They view you basically as a tourist, because Seattle is supposed to be an exclusive city for woke progressives. Anybody else, and you're coming in a car, you're seen as the enemy or someone we can at least take more money from. This is highway robbery. I think that might be considered a pun. Not sure. This is absolute robbery. The service that the city provides never gets any better, even though we're giving them more money. The roads here seem to be falling apart way worse than they've had in the past. We get no better customer service coming from anyone. And the truth of the matter is, We still can't find parking. Good luck finding parking even after these rates are implemented and people realize it. Again, they go in today, but I'm assuming there won't be people who realize it until they try to find a spot and they go, oh my God, $4.50, $5, what happened? That's nuts. And all of this means people will be spending less dollars. If you can't find a parking spot, or if you're going to be rushed into getting out from that lunch or restaurant dinner date that you're on, you're just not going to come. You're just not going to come here. Imagine this. You're going out for shopping in downtown Seattle, and then you want to stop for lunch. But in the back of your mind, you're thinking, my God, every hour I spend out here is an extra $4.50. When you park, how many hours are you going to assume? You're going to just assume 2 hours or 3 hours. Well, if you've been shopping for 2 hours and now you're hungry and you want to go get something to eat and you're with a friend, you're probably going to say to yourself, eh, we're not going to be able to do it. Let's go somewhere else. You hop in the car and you leave. That hurts a business. That hurts a restaurant. I know that there's some folks in Seattle who want to pretend that nothing is different, that the economy is rip-roaring. It's stronger than ever. No, it's not. Businesses are still suffering. And now you're putting this on top of everything else. And what it is that people are buying while in downtown Seattle or anywhere in Seattle, way more expensive because of inflation due to, again, Democrat policies and out-of-control spending. This is just absurd. So, again, remember, the next time any activist talks about how it's so expensive to live in Seattle, remember that they are the reason why it is so expensive to live in Seattle. Now this.
The interview.
Well, this should come as no shock to you, but Washington State's homeless population has grown pretty significantly, and it's all due, mostly due, to Seattle and King County. The number of Washingtonians who are homeless, this includes people who moved here from out of state, they grew by 10% between 2020 and 2022. Joining me on the line with her reaction is Andrea Suarez from We Heart Seattle. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hello, hello. So thank you for having me on.
You work in this world. You've been fighting against a lot of the policies that I think you and I both share the same opinion have enabled homelessness to continue. I'm assuming you're not shocked by this number.
No, not whatsoever. I mean, on a daily basis, people are coming in out of state. I mean, we have to address the inflow issue.
How many would you guess are coming in from out of state? You're talking to these folks. How often do you hear from someone who says, yeah, I'm from, you know, Las Vegas. I'm from L.A.?
It's daily. I mean, we are out there every single day, daily boots on the ground. And every day I just got somebody at a sanctioned camp. I love Camp United We Stand. He was living under Edgar Martinez Plaza. I said, you know, what's your name? Where are you from? He's like, I'm from California. I've been here a week. And, you know, I take him to the camp and, you know, hey, you can't have any open warrants. So I don't have any warrants. Sure enough, we run his card. He's got warrants. People come to Seattle because it's a no rules playground. And there's rumors that free housing for all if you live under a bridge.
Well, I wouldn't call that a rumor at this point, would you? I mean, isn't that basically what the state is saying?
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly what they're saying. And they are not offering any incremental solutions like immediate sanctioned camps. Tent City 3, Camp United We Stand. We could stand up 100 pallet shelter units a week if the county would simply work with an Everett-based manufacturer of tiny homes. I love tiny homes. Barb the Builder's great too, but we also have a mass producer that can produce 100 of those a week. Now, I'm not for that without recovery-oriented programs that
That's
come with that. And with, right, and with an incentive to progress at the 90-day mark, you must be in some form of recovery because my knowledge also tells me that this is an addiction crisis, first and foremost. So, people are coming here on the daily, walking down Third Avenue with a new set of luggage, you know, asking for housing, asking for hotels. It's not a rumor. It's not an urban legend. You know, I know it's a conservative talking point. You guys know, your audience knows, We Heart Seattle, we're apolitical. I'm personally, you know, moderate, and I can't bite my tongue anymore that there's an inflow crisis as much as there is an addiction crisis, and we're not going to build our way out of this.
We're very clearly not. And for anyone who thinks that all you have to do is build a home and put someone in it, then you've solved homelessness, you don't understand the crisis. There are maybe a very small handful of people who that could actually help. Those are the people who are already looking for services and getting the resources to get their lives back on track. the majority of the homelessness that we're talking about, it's driven by chronically homeless. People are dealing with a mental health issue that hasn't been addressed or an addiction that hasn't been addressed. You put them in a home, you still haven't solved why they were homeless to begin with, and they're just going to end up killing themselves slowly, maybe more comfortably because they're inside of a home, but they're still going to end up dying. They weren't born homeless. They got that way.
Yeah, I mean, the root cause is often broken relationships. And, you know, what's just not being talked about are these overdose deaths inside the tiny house villages, inside the hotels. I mean, you kind of have to dig and scrape for those articles out there. I have somebody that works within one of the transitional housing projects, and they had 12 overdoses last year, and the year before was 2. So overdoses are going up when shelter is provided. This whole notion that there's hundreds of people that need to be housed and sheltered under the Ship Canal Bridge, which is being cleaned out today. You know, I've been there on the regular, and it's a different person every single time. And it's a revolving door. And I don't know how they come up with 150 people that we need to find a hotel for when, you know, it's not what the city is telling us. You know, you got to go look for yourself. And I invite the city, the city needs to talk to private funded agencies like me who will tell them the straight truth. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything to hide. I don't have an agenda. I don't have to pretend there's people there that aren't there. You know, the gentleman that burned down all the boats, you know, he had a tiny house. He didn't stay there because, you know, didn't have for enough storage for him. He's a known person. He lived in Green Lake. He lived out on Aurora and 125th. He was out on 80th. You know, he came from California, has a family, you know, and just came here and got into the life of crime and you know, now burned down, what, 40, 50 boats and caused community harm. So,
But no big deal. If we get too hard on them, you know, it lacks compassion. And you're criminalizing the poor. It's just the talking points are annoying at this point, but they're hurting their own cause. And I have to hope that at some point people start to realize that the same people who have been in charge this entire time with the same approach this entire time has led to the crisis that we currently have. And I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, if housing first and harm reduction were working policies, we wouldn't have the numbers that were in the headlines today. The problem's getting worse, so we need to rethink our policies. And we do that through a grassroots movement. We Heart Seattle, we're out there, and we use litter picks as a direct action strategy to disrupt the narrative, disrupt the conversation, and the narrative, and counterbalance what we believe is a addiction and untreated mental illness crisis, first and foremost. So,
well, you're doing a tremendous job. I hope people will check out WeHeartSeattle.org. Consider donating. This is an organization that works off of your donations, and they are incredibly successful in the work that they do, much more so than city and county leaders. WeHeartSeattle.org. Andrea Suarez, thank you so much for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Thanks for letting me on. Talk
Absolutely.
To you later.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Well, some bad news, unfortunately, we brought to you last week. President Joe Biden has committed to working with Democrats who have said, yeah, we're going to tear down 4 hydropower dams in Washington. Not an especially good idea, given the amount of clean energy we get from it. Joining me on the line, someone who knows a thing or two about this topic. He's the president of the American Conservation Coalition, where I serve as an evergreen advisor, Benji Backer. Welcome back to the show.
It is great to be here. Pretty important topic right now.
It really is. Let's start with the fact that maybe we shouldn't be all that concerned because President Biden doesn't seem to know which rivers we're even talking about.
Yeah, that's right. He used the wrong rivers in his comment about the dams here in Washington State, and also just the inability to kind of understand the issue itself past the name of the river is pretty blatant, in that there's kind of this black and white mentality that happens in the environmental community these days, which he happens to represent right now, which is you either have to have all of something or none of something. And he believes wrongly that we need to tear down the dams or we can't have fish. And the reality is actually in between of having as many dams and killing as many fish as possible and having no dams and killing zero fish. It's not that black and white, and that's just something he doesn't seem to understand.
What makes sense that helps continue to deliver us clean energy but also help salmon population?
Yeah, what he doesn't realize also is that if you remove the hydropower dams from Washington State, we would have to rely on coal or natural gas or other sources of energy because, it might be shocking to people, but if the sun doesn't shine at night and the wind doesn't blow 24/7, and so those sources only work for when they're when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, and so we need those hydropower dams. So what a lot of people have proposed, and I was just in Spokane last week, with the Spokane tribe, learning about what they're doing to divert salmon around the dams via fish ladders, via these things called salmon cannons, where they shoot the salmon out of a cannon into the river past the dam. There's so many different sources of technology that divert the salmon populations around these dams. All of that would be able to happen in conjunction with partners of the tribes, of the dams, of the energy companies. All of that can happen, but right now this proposal is making it so that we would have to go to that blatant kind of other side and just take these things down when we don't have to.
And I should say, in fairness, it's not just Democrats who hold this position. We are talking about Patty Murray, Maria Cantwell, but we're also talking about a Republican out of Idaho, Mike Simpson. He's a congressman who is siding with the Democrats on this particular issue. Why do you think there is a disconnect between what we're hearing from the Biden administration and the group of lawmakers versus what you're saying?
Well, I think it's because they don't quite understand the complexities of the issue. I mean, when I toured this hydropower dam, the Long Lake Dam in eastern Washington, it was very obvious that these people aren't going to visit these dams, these leaders who are calling for the removal of them. And it's kind of like AOC not going to visit a fossil fuel plant, but going after fossil fuel facilities and fossil fuel workers. If you don't understand the actual localities and the actual communities around that issue, and you don't understand the employees and you don't understand the technology, then you're not going to call for the right solution. And right now, that's what the Biden administration and these other leaders are doing. I don't think that's ill-intentioned. I think that they are truly trying to basically bring up the salmon population, but they're not thinking about how we could do it in other ways that would be so much less damaging to the economy, to clean energy, to the communities that basically rely on these energy sources for cheap, affordable, reliable, and, like I said, clean energy.
But that's where I guess I just don't understand. Where do they think the clean energy will then come from? They know the limitations of the other technologies that we're using. They clearly know the limitations there, which is why we're not seeing some kind of expansion in that world to make up for the fact that we just are going to end up being reliant on dirty energy.
That's right. And I think what is a problem with the left on this issue is also not just that they know these realities. It's also that their voters don't know the realities. I know so many young people that I talk to who don't understand how solar and wind work, how turning your light on 24/7 is because some sort of energy source is powering our homes. That seems really common sense, but not everyone thinks about the way that energy powers their lives every day. I would argue that they probably should, but not everyone does that. So it's harder for people to identify what they should be doing on the energy policy side of things. And so these politicians are beholden to this kind of oversimplified rhetoric that they have to portray, which is basically, oh yeah, we could tear down these dams and just power Washington with other energy sources, because that's what the public on their side wants them to say and wants them to believe without even knowing that that's not possible.
The other aspect of this story that I suspect is at play here is this commitment to the so-called equity movement, because there are Native American groups and a tribe, several tribes actually, that have adopted this approach to breaching the dams. How much do you think that's playing a role in, you know, we're told we have to pay a special attention to the BIPOC community rather than everybody, and the I in BIPOC is indigenous?
Well, they can listen to those tribes, or they can listen to the other tribes that don't want them to tear down these dams.
Exactly.
Because they know that it's important for their communities. I mean, it's not just, again, it's not just tribes against dams or tribes for dams. There's a lot of tribes who are for the dams. And I was just touring that Spokane tribe that was very much in favor of keeping the dams in eastern Washington while also putting in conservation technology measures to divert the salmon. There's a way to do these things. It's a yes and strategy. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to cater to this kind of, like I said, oversimplified black and white strategy and make it sound like it's for the minority communities that are around these dams. But in reality, they're not even speaking to these tribes and these communities, because if they did, they'd understand that a lot of them aren't in favor of breaching the dams, and that there's a way to marry this economic growth and renewable energy and salmon population all at the same time.
Talking with Benji Backer, he is the president of the American Conservation Coalition, acc.eco, acc.eco is their website. There was a monologue that Tucker Carlson provided last, I think, Tuesday, and he went into some of the environmentalists who have been telling us that the world is going to end, and they are pretty specific about when something's going to happen. By 2000, we'll run out of oil. By 2005, we'll have most of the coasts have risen by 12 feet or whatever. All of these sort of doomsday, I don't even want to call them predictions, because they're saying them with certainty, and they never come true. How much does that hurt the environmentalist cause?
Oh, it absolutely hurts them, and it should, because the science doesn't back up these claims. And that's actually something that's really frustrated the scientific community, is that, you know, the Jay Inslees of the world, the AOCs of the world, they make these dire predictions that aren't even scientifically true. The climate scientists who believe that we're contributing to these, you know, these rising temperatures and rising sea levels say that it's a marginal change over time that we should be aware of and we should be doing things about, but it's not going to cause these doomsday scenarios. They say that. And yet the rhetoric from the left is that it's basically going to kill us all tomorrow, when that's not factually correct at all. And so then when people know that that's not factually correct, because those predictions come and pass and the bad things that they say don't happen, then the scientific community, which didn't even say those things in the first place, loses all the credibility in the world, because everyone thinks that they did. And the AOCs of the world are just doing that to drum up attention, to fundraise, to get more Twitter followers and more Instagram followers. But it's coming at the expense of the scientific community. It's mm-hmm. coming at the expense of actually moving forward on the issue. And it's coming at the expense of our country, because we're pursuing these radical ideas that aren't even backed by science, but they're being talked about in the name of science. I think it's pretty shameful, and it's something that we have to be more aware of as Americans, that these mm-hmm. people are lying to us.
Well, and it's also the media amplification of these claims. Anytime something happens that's weather-related, immediately, without even looking into it, they immediately say, right, well, climate change, regardless. And anytime someone like AOC makes her proclamations, or anyone makes those proclamations, it gets amplified as truth, not as a position, not as an opinion, not as analysis, but as just a factual truth that in 12 years will be done. I think, what are we, up to year six of the 12? It seems like we're probably not going to end in six more years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they say those things, and they justify it by saying, well, it's getting attention to this issue and people are paying more attention to it, but it's coming at the expense of the vast majority of the population that realizes that this isn't even remotely accurate. And I'm someone who wants to start, you know, decarbonizing and moving away from, you know, unnecessary pollution in our atmosphere and unnecessary pollution in our environment. I think we all can agree on that, but yet it's being dominated by this radical ideology that prevents that very thing from happening. Mm-hmm. And we could move so much faster towards a cleaner future if we didn't have these radical voices trying to shift the entire way our American economy works.
Well, and it just drives me nuts that the left has taken ownership of this movement. When you think about environmentalism, it's the conservatives who are out there hunting and camping, and they're going fishing. They're the ones who care deeply about the environment. They're the ones who are saying, hey, let's maybe invest in new technologies to make the world cleaner, but also businesses be a little bit more efficient and not go out of business, because we're looking at this not as an anti-capitalist movement, which is what too many people on the left actually look at environmentalism. And that's why I'm glad you guys are doing such great work at the ACC. American Conservation Coalition, acc.eco is their website. See what they're up to and maybe consider joining up. Benji Backer, president. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely amazing to be here. Thanks.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Well, I had a weekend in which I vowed never to use Lyft again and never to use Hertz rental cars again. And it was a decision I made after a series of inexplicable moves by both of those companies. And it came out of a weekend that was actually a pretty pleasant one. I had the honor to speak at the Mason County Republicans Lincoln Day dinner. I gave my speech. I met a lot of really nice people. And I stayed at the Little Creek Hotel and Resort Casino, which, by the way, their door system with the little magnetic cards to open doors, awful. Other than that, wonderful stay. Well, their showers could probably be renovated, but I'm nitpicking. What I'm not nitpicking on is the customer service, or lack thereof, from both Hertz and Lyft. Now, as you know, I do not drive a car. I do not own a car. I know how to drive. I just don't. It is a burden that I do not need right now in my life. And so I had a few options to get to the event in Shelton. Number one, I could borrow a friend's car, but that wasn't available. I could get a car to go or a gig car, which is just a rental for an overnight to the tune of $120, or via the Lyft app, get a Hertz rental car for $42 and earn like 10 times the points per dollar spent because I have Lyft membership through my bank. And so obviously $42 versus $120 plus tax, whatever, is a pretty significant saving. So I decided, hey, I'm going to go with Hertz. Going to go the old route, just getting a rental car. And so I, using the Lyft app, Lyft, by the way, car share service, ride share service, like Uber, I reserved my vehicle for 11:30 in the morning on Saturday. I get at the Hertz a little after 11:30, just a couple minutes, maybe 5 minutes. And as I'm walking in, first of all, this is the one in downtown Seattle, right by the convention center. The Hertz office on the ground floor is completely empty. It's like they shut down early. And then I find a sign that says, actually, if you go directly up to the sixth floor, you'll be able to connect. So I say, okay. So I go up to the sixth floor. And the window is closed, but there are three employees inside. And so one of them gives me a look like I'm bothering them. I'm like, oh, no. And so he reluctantly, begrudgingly opens the sliding glass window and says, sorry, we're out of cars. And to me, I was thinking, well, that's fine. I'm not a walk-in guy. I reserved it. And so I said something along the lines, oh, no, it's fine. I'm not a walk-up customer. I have this reservation. And I show him. And he goes, no, we're out. We're out of cars. I mean, what do you mean you're out of cars? I have a reservation. Yeah, we gave all the cars away. And I'm standing there a little dumbstruck because while I have some expectation of customer service, this was beyond anything I could imagine. Now, I don't expect it to be the best customer service in the world, but I expect some. And then they close the lights. I'm standing there and I'm still looking through my phone to see what I'm supposed to do. And they just close, they close the lights. So I go on Twitter and I make a note of it. I tell them Hertz is awful, blah, 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 blah. Hertz reaches out to me, says, so sorry you experienced this. Could you take another car at a different location? By the time I got that note, I was already done with my speech in Shelton. So I said, no, I needed it at 11:30, not at, 10:30 p.m. And then I get a note back saying, we're going to give you a $50 gift certificate. We just need your address and we'll send it on over to you. To which I, and this is how you know I'm serious, I said, no, I'm never using your service again. I don't need your $50. What in God's name is the point of a reservation if you're not going to honor it? I went through a Seinfeld moment, as many people online pointed out to me on Twitter. I went through a Seinfeld moment. Why do you have a reservation if there are no intentions of fulfilling them? You know how many people reserved a car. So why are you giving away cars to people without reservations? Or did you oversell, wondering whether or not someone might not show up? Does that happen often? I don't know. I don't know how often that would happen. But it just seems odd to me that that's what would happen. And not a phone call, not a text from Lyft via the app saying, hey, we ran out of cars. Our sincerest apologies. Nothing. You're on your own. So I ended up taking a gig car. And to get to the nearest gig car that had gasoline in it was a $23 ride via Lyft. So I'm trying to reach Lyft to see what happened. And, of course, I want my $23 back. On top of that, I would like to see the difference between the $42 and the $120 or so dollars that I spent. I'm not holding my breath on that one, but I should get the comp on the drive to the other rideshare vehicle, which I would not have needed to take had it not been for their incompetence. You go on the app, there's no phone number. There's no way to contact anyone. Then you go through the automated process. There's no options for anything that I'm trying to do here. I don't know how to put any of this in. And the only option I would have in order to connect with someone is if I throw the driver under the bus, the Lyft driver, which I don't want to do. She was very pleasant. So then I go online, no way to contact them. So finally, I go through their Twitter feed. They refuse to respond. I see them responding at the Ask Lyft account. I see them responding to everybody else. They are not responding to me. I'm the only one they're not responding to, it seems. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that I'm a conservative. Then I go on their Facebook page. Finally, I connect with someone. And on the Facebook page, I use a completely made-up name. No one can tell it's me. It's a burner account that I use just so I have access to anything that we might need to see. I don't use it for anything. So I get someone to respond to my concerns, except they say, you have to prove who you are. We need you to take a screenshot of this piece of the app. So the place that they told me to go does not exist on the app. This must be an old instruction, to which I tell them, that's not anywhere on the app, but here's what I think you're talking about. And then they respond, no, we're going to, how about this? Go to the profile page and screenshot that. So I do that, send it over. Then they ask for the exact same thing again, to which I said, I just sent it, but okay, here it is again. And then they send me another note saying I need to send in what I just sent them twice. I don't know if there's a human being behind it or if this is all automated, but this is the most maddening experience for customer service. And I know that apps generally make it difficult for you to contact someone personally, like a human being, but there is, eventually you find a way. I have no idea how to do that. And so rather than move forward with either of these companies, I'm done. I am done. I don't like boycotts based on politics, even though I do suspect that Lyft is ignoring me on Twitter, at least because I'm a conservative. They might have seen my latest Tucker appearance. I don't like those kinds of moves. However, when you fail to provide just a basic service and your customer service is this poor, I'm done. I am out. So I am no longer going to use Lyft. I'm never going to use Hertz. If you ever see me in any of those vehicles, you have full permission to shame me publicly for not living up to my promise. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation as I complain about Hertz and Lyft. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.